Welcome to KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. We're on Twitter at KUOW. Right now in the flooded Houston, Texas area, they've been dealing with this chemical plant, among many other things, this plant that lost power followed by explosions and fires. There's some dispute as to how toxic the smoke from that fire might be. We told you on Monday about a local Pierce County search and rescue team that was driving to Texas to help with the flood waters. These are men and women who are firefighters and police officers, structural engineers in their day jobs. Now they're working with FEMA, the Federal Disaster Agency. When they first got to Texas, it was worse than they thought. Their safe zone to set up their equipment had to be pushed back five times as the water kept rising. Finally, they set up in College Station, Texas, an hour and a half away from Houston, and let's see what has happened since then. Welcome back, Scott Hines of the Pierce County Emergency Management Department.
Good afternoon. Thank you for having me.
Scott, what stories is your team telling you about conditions in Southeast Texas?
Well, now that we've had them on the ground, and you're absolutely right, the travels to get there were a lot longer than had anticipated. Five different points of stop finally set up their base of operations in College Station. They were able to get a night's sleep in an outbuilding, basically a barn. They took a shower in a horse stall with a hose and got up yesterday morning and went to work. And it is really unprecedented conditions when you think of the historical rain. You know, we see a Pineapple Express through this area, the deluge of rain. That's been going on for days and days, continues to rain, and it's wreaking havoc with the environment, sewage in the water, animal carcasses in the water, alligators and snakes and all sorts of critters that you might associate with Texas, in addition to the people that they're trying to get to help. So it is incredibly challenging situation under in a stressful environment, and time is of the essence because many of these survivors have been stranded. They need to get to them in order to evacuate them to a safe zone. So they've been busy as part of a grid search, going door to door, house to house, assessing if there are people inside. And interestingly enough, they've actually had some folks where they've reached the house and they've refused to be evacuated. They've said that they're going to stay in place and ride it out.
And what is your team supposed to do then? Are they just saying, well, good luck and move on? Or do they get a little more coercive? Get out of here.
Yeah, our team has no authority to force people to evacuate. So they offer the opportunity to be moved to a safe zone. When people refuse, they respectfully accept that refusal and they move on to the next house. We're now encountering situations because of the weather and because of the environmental conditions where not only do you have survivors from the hurricane that need to be rescued, but there are so many public safety personnel that they are finding themselves separated from their group, stranded or trapped by rising floodwaters. So the work out there is not only for the public, but also for public safety. And if someone refuses help, it gets acknowledged, and then they move on to the next person that might need to be assisted.
You say your team is going house to house. Are they walking? Are they traveling by boat?
Yeah, it is boat only at this point. So they are on their boat. They have, as part of the FEMA plan for search and rescue, it is somewhat structured. So they perform these grid searches. They have a geographical area that they're required to cover. And they boat from house to house. They get up to wherever they can. In some instances, they're able to get up on a staircase. So they would get out of their boat, up on a staircase, and knock on the door. But it is not where they are deployed. It's not walkable. It's only you're only able to reach houses by boat.
Has your team been having to give emergency medical treatment? And Scott, has everyone they have found been alive?
To date, the information we've received is they've only come across people that are alive. I think it's important to note that given the duration of this incident, and as the water recedes, it's very likely that they're going to find more deceased victims. You have people that have been without food and water, dehydration sets in, people that may have been on supplemental oxygen, diabetics in need of insulin, people with other medical conditions that tried to survive but weren't able to. And with the rising flood water, you have folks that have gone from floor to floor to floor. They may eventually have reached the limits of where they could evacuate in a vertical evacuation, and they get trapped. So while we've not had reports of our team encountering any fatalities, that's very likely to happen in the next few days.
You told us on Monday about danger for flood victims and for your rescue team with flood waters that can be toxic. You already told us about livestock and alligators, but sewage and chemicals. And has that proven true?
Yeah, absolutely. There's no real way to test the water and to understand what's in the water. So our folks are assuming that there are caustic substances in the water. But you hear reports of sanitation systems, water systems, sewer systems that are inoperable. So you have that now out into the water, as well as days and days worth of diesel fuel, oil, gasoline, antifreeze, those sorts of automobile-related chemicals, and then household chemicals. And it's also important to note that they're in one of the biggest chemical-producing industry regions in our country, and you're starting to see implications from what happens when those facilities don't have the power and the cooling system that they need in order to keep those systems safe and operable.
Talking with Scott Hines with Pierce County Emergencies Management Department. He's got this search and rescue team down working for FEMA in Houston. How's your team doing, and what do they need?
Well, the morale is high. I think that they were happy to be out of the car after traveling for basically 2 days straight. They are heroes headed into harm's way, and they're now able to perform the work that they signed up to perform. So as we've spoken with them, they're focused. They're optimistic that they're going to continue to be able to perform a search and recovery or search and rescue or search and evacuation mission. And some of the creature comforts that we all take for granted, socks. So we're sending them more socks. It's with all of the rain and the humidity, nothing ever truly dries out down there. So keeping your feet, if you're a hiker or an outdoors person, you know that keeping your feet happy goes a long ways to your overall well-being. So we're making certain that they have those sorts of things that they need in order to be able to perform their mission on a daily basis. We're also tracking Tropical Storm Irma. So as Harvey begins to dissipate and move out of the area, it did pass back through the Gulf yesterday and re-energize and make landfall again. But there's Tropical Storm Irma, which is out over Puerto Rico right now. And the path, one of the paths we've seen it tracking, would bring it right back in over the area impacted by Harvey. So while we're hopeful that Harvey will continue to dissipate, there may be another tropical storm right behind it that could provide additional rainfall that will hamper recovery efforts.
Remarkable work, and we're wishing the best for the people of Southeast Texas and for your team as well. Scott, thanks again for this.
Thank you, Bill. Appreciate it.
Talk to Scott Hines on Monday, and there's the update from the Deputy Director of the Pierce County Department of Emergency Management. He just talked about dry socks. Nothing dries out in Houston. Let's talk about how you can help folks like that who are suffering, who are trying to recover. If you're thinking about donating money to the people of Houston, my next guest says that is a great impulse, but be careful how you think about your donations. Amy Costello is the founder and managing editor of a podcast called Tiny Spark. She reports on philanthropy and nonprofits and international aid. Amy, welcome to KUOW.
Thanks so much for having me, Bill.
So how should we think about our donations to Southeast Texas?
Well, you know, I think your last guest, Scott Hines, was an excellent example of the kind of experts you want to be giving to at this phase. He clearly demonstrates a deep knowledge of his work, his very specific work in helping people get out of their homes. He's with a team of people who know what they're doing. He's not fly-by-night going there by himself with a boat. So there's a lot of good indications. Those are the kinds of organizations and the kinds of skills that you're looking for. The fact of the matter is, this is in the very early stages of what's going to be a very long-term recovery, and we don't yet know what specific skills are going to be needed as this community begins to recover. And so I think what you want to look for are people who have done that specific kind of work in the past have shown themselves to be effective and who have deep knowledge and expertise about the specific work they're carrying out.
Isn't there somebody else who does this work for us, Amy? What's wrong with just writing a check to whoever, the Red Cross or whatever organization you figure is going to find out where it should go?
Well, you know, the Red Cross has a very specific kind of work that it does, which is disaster relief. They've proven themselves to be good at times at giving things like water, blankets, and shelter to people who need it. And so if that is the need that you want to support, you want to go to an organization that does that kind of work. As far as I know, you know, there's other organizations who will be able to help people rebuild homes, who will be able to help, you know, drain schools that are flooded, who will provide counseling and trauma therapy to people who have lost their homes. You know, there's all kinds of myriad issues that are going to arise, and I think it's important for donors to do a little bit of research, for them to decide what part of the recovery they would like to fund, and make sure that the organization that they're giving to, you know, kind of what I say is kind of staying in their lane, or can be when a lot of money comes to an organization, there can be a tendency to want to try to do all kinds of things. And I don't think that's appropriate. We need experts who know what they're doing to deliver a very specific kind of relief or recovery.
So you're saying the donor needs to do some research. What is the best way to do that research?
Well, I mean, I think right now one of the problems with the nonprofit sector is that most of the money goes to a relative handful of nonprofits working in the sector. There are many small grassroots organizations working in communities there in Seattle, in Houston, in other places that know the community well, that is trusted by the community, and can carry out work on their behalf and in partnership with them. And so I think, you know, one thing you can do is to give to, you know, yes, the Red Cross is the one that comes to mind. They get the lion's share of donations in events like this. But as many of your, you know, listeners know, there's been some investigations into their work and questions made about their ability to respond meaningfully to a disaster of this size. And so I do think it's important for donors to look at other organizations as well who can deliver maybe on a smaller scale to a certain community. There's different websites that you can go to, GuideStar being one of them, where you can look at nonprofits' tax returns. Charity Navigator is another one that rates nonprofits. These are all, you know, starting points. But I also really think it's important that donors ideally keep their eyes on the long-term recovery of this community, because right now we're all enthusiastic and want to try to help. The fact of the matter is these people are going to need help for months, if not years. And so one thing to think about is, can you become a sustaining donor? Can you donate this month? But how about at, you know, December? And how about next year? Can you just have a small debit card donation given to a good nonprofit so that they can count on your donation in the very difficult years ahead after a lot of us and all the cameras have left the area to help continue to help the people who are going to need our help clearly well beyond, you know, this month?
Yeah, I want to ask you about that, Amy. First of all, since we mentioned the Red Cross, NPR has been doing good work reporting, and so have others, on pros and some cons with the Red Cross's work and also some ways to help. So we are going to tweet out to our listeners right now a useful link or two where that'll help you help the people of Southeast Texas. So join us on Twitter at KUOW. Now, Amy Costello from Tiny Spark Podcast, you were just telling us that there can be a problem with sending your money in now and not later. You mentioned a recurring donation. That makes sense. Can you tell us what is wrong with a bunch of money and donations coming in right now at the beginning of a disaster?
Well, you want your money to be able to flow out into the sector, right? You want your money to flow out kind of relatively quickly to people who need it. And then so it's going to, you know, windfalls of money can be seen as a great thing at a time like this, but they can also present an incredible challenge to organizations just being able to handle that kind of money and get it out in a responsible manner. And so, you know, while we have an immediate crisis before us, and I would, you know, the other thing I just tweeted out talking of Twitter is I have asked the Red Cross what their fundraising goal is, and I'm not sure if they've said what it is yet or not. I don't know which of these organizations people are giving to, if they have a stated fundraising goal, and once they've met that goal, is it time to cut off the fundraising campaign because, and that's what the Doctors Without Borders did in Haiti after the earthquake. They raised enough money and they said, thank you so much. We don't need any more. That's all we need. And so I think it's important to think about, can these organizations handle an influx of cash right now? Hopefully they can, but that can be a challenge. And that's why I think if organizations, certainly when they meet their fundraising goal, you can think, okay, well, they've met it for now, but they're going to need help 6 months down the road, a year down the road. Why don't I wait and see what the needs are? We're hearing about a chemical spill now in Houston. What kind of organizations are going to need to come up to clean up that and to make people safe? A very different kind of organization, most likely, than the Red Cross. Highly specialized. Can we help them? You know, so I think a little bit of prudence and a little bit of waiting to see, once immediate needs are met, where your donor dollars can best be channeled, you know, is kind of a wise course of action.
Okay, just a couple more questions, Amy. You are in Austin, Texas, just a couple of hours' drive from Houston, and you report on philanthropy on your podcast. Why are you not in Houston right now?
Yeah, you know, it's something I've been thinking about a lot in the last few days, and I've been torn about it, but I've also been involved in a number of crisis situations. I worked for 5 years in Africa. And what I'm aware of and is, you know, I've thought to myself, is it a good use of resources for me to go down and be trying to interview people who are trying to deliver aid right now? Is that a good use of their time? And I kind of think that there's people who are very busy on the front lines of this emergency response doing the work they need to do. And I want to let them do that. And, you know, there's plenty of very fine journalists there now covering this disaster in all kinds of ways, and that is great, too. I feel like my role, and kind of like what I'm encouraging your listeners to do, is to just wait a little bit and see how things pan out. I have lots of questions I have about how this donor dollars will be spent over the next months and years. I think those are very important questions to ask. I feel like that's where I can offer my biggest contribution. And to go down now in the midst of an unfolding complex emergency and interview people who are trying to help and their families, well, some organizations are doing that, and I think there's a role for that. I'm not sure that that's my role, and but I do know that I do have a role as this crisis unfolds, and I'm very grateful that I am just a few hours' drive from Houston, and I plan to go there hopefully several times in the months and years ahead.
What is the most important question you'll be answering on your podcast, The Tiny Spark, about philanthropy?
Well, you know, when I reported from Africa for 5 years, I always flew into busy capitals of different countries and immediately almost got out and went down dirt roads to find people who were the hardest to reach and who had the least access to resources, because I knew that that was where the story always was, not in the big cities, but out in these harder to access communities. And I think that I'll probably kind of have that lens again, that there's going to be well-resourced communities who get back on their feet very quickly, but there's going to be communities who are struggling mightily before this crisis ever hit, and I can't imagine what their journey will be post-hurricane. So I'm kind of interested in how are the communities that are hardest hit with the least resources being served by these donor dollars, by FEMA, by well-intentioned donors, and just following up and following up and following up and asking well-intentioned people and projects, what are your qualifications? What are you doing? And, you know, and are the people that you say that you're served being served? And I think there is a great role for journalists of all kinds to continue to ask those questions. And I think those are the questions that will emerge, you know, again, in the months and years after this immediate crisis is over.
And Amy, as you do that, as you follow up and follow up and follow up on these good intentions and watchdog these organizations, can we keep checking in with you about just this storm, Harvey, you know, and the aftermath, and find out what you're learning so we can learn about how to effectively help?
I would, and I just think, absolutely, and I just think it's important to say with all my stories, I always try to find out what is working and why and what can we learn from it. So
yeah.
That'll be, again, foremost on my mind is the lessons that we're learning, how we can do this work better, and who's doing it well, and what can we learn from them. So I'll be happy to share those stories with you, too.
What actually works and how to get to them. Amy Costello, managing editor of the Tiny Spark podcast, looking at philanthropy and nonprofit organizations. Thank you, Amy.
Thank you very much.
We're tweeting out a link to Amy's podcast right now, and keep it tuned to KUOW. We'll follow the unfolding events in Houston and Southeast Texas and continue to help you understand your role and what you can do to help. We're going to be right back with KUOW's The Record in a moment. On Twitter, at KUOW, this is The Record. I'm Bill Radke. King County has an overdose problem. 359 people died last year from overdosing, more than the year before. And, of course, there's a regional crisis as well. Most of those overdoses were from opioids like heroin and fentanyl. There is a way that I'll bet you heard about to stop an overdose in its tracks. You've heard about the drug naloxone. Its brand name is Narcan. It can pull somebody back from death, which can sound like a magic bullet solution. Is it? Let's find out more now. University of Washington researcher Caleb Banta-Green is with the school's Alcohol and Drug Abuse Institute. Welcome back, Caleb.
Thank you very much for having me.
In basic terms, how does naloxone work?
Sure. So your brain is filled with opioid receptors. They usually bind to endorphins, which is a natural opioid in the brain. And if you think about that like a lock and key, those keyholes are the receptors. And normally endorphins or opioids bind to those receptors, they go into the keyhole and they turn, they activate it. So what naloxone does is it binds very, very strongly. It pushes those out, pushes those opioids out of the keyhole and blocks that keyhole. It doesn't turn it on, but it blocks it. And it lasts for about 30 to 90 minutes. Those opioids are still in the brain. They're still moving around. They're slowly metabolizing and wearing off. But then naloxone is a short-term emergency rescue medicine. It is blocking those opioid receptors. And if a person has had an overdose, which generally what opioids do is they slow breathing down and a person, carbon dioxide builds up in the lungs and they literally start suffocating. They actually stop breathing and they die. So what happens is you're interrupting that process and you are blocking those opiates. You're blocking that respiratory depressant effect. And a person can literally within 2 to 3 minutes wake up.
They go from not breathing to being up and talking in a couple of minutes?
That's correct.
What are the side effects?
Well, the side effects are not really due to naloxone. They're due to the fact that a person is going into withdrawal. So a person uses opioids every day becomes dependent on opiates. And if they stop using, they go into withdrawal. That's true whether you're a chronic pain patient or whether you're injecting heroin. Everybody's body responds in that way. So the main effect that happens with naloxone is a person goes into sudden rapid withdrawal. They're going to feel really bad. They're going to go back to feeling like they have the terrible flu and they may vomit. They'll be fine. Withdrawal is not a life-threatening event, but they're not going to feel good.
By the way, what are the lingering effects of an overdose?
Well, it really depends. I mean, you know, if you survive an overdose, and only about 1 in 20 opiate overdoses is fatal, at least involving heroin. So about 5% are actually fatal, but there are a lot of consequences. Very oftentimes people will get injured, they'll fall, they can be harmed that way, they can actually have brain damage, they can have a lack of oxygen to the brain, they may end up being paralyzed. And of course, if you do get it's traumatizing to both the, actually less so to the person who has the overdose and more to the people around them, but then it may also be stuck with expensive hospital bills and other social and economic consequences.
Okay, so back to the naloxone that can bring somebody back from near death. Do you have to be a medical professional to inject it right?
Not at all. There's very good research that shows that lay people can learn how to recognize an overdose and intervene in an overdose as well as an emergency medical trained person. What's important to understand is naloxone can be given intravenously. That's how medical professionals use it generally. It can be used intramuscularly, injected into the shoulder or the butt, and it can be used intranasally. There are several new products. The new brand name you mentioned, Narcan, is one of those products. It can also be used intranasally.
Do you carry naloxone on the street and inject strangers who won't wake up?
I thankfully have never had to administer it. I did purchase the first kit at a pharmacy at Kelly Ross Pharmacy in October 2012. I was allowed to do that under Washington state law as a person who could potentially witness an opiate overdose. So I do own naloxone in case I do witness an overdose.
You have to be certified?
Not at all. Anybody in Washington state who may have or witness an opioid overdose per 2010 state law is allowed to have, possess, and administer naloxone. It is a prescription medication. The pharmacist can directly prescribe it to you, just like the flu. A flu vaccine, they also are directly actually prescribing that to you. So you can get it directly from a pharmacy. You can get it from a physician. You can also get it from public health, syringe exchange, and other places are distributing take-home naloxone.
If somebody is unconscious, whether they're a stranger or not, you don't know whether they've overdosed or not. If you have Narcan, if you have naloxone, inject the naloxone?
No. The idea with naloxone is that if you see a person down and you have no idea why, you should go through standard CPR protocols.
Okay.
You should always call 911. If they don't have a pulse, do chest compressions. It's only in the instance where you know the person has used opioids.
Yeah. If you use naloxone first, would it block the pleasurable effects of heroin?
For a very short time effect, yes. Naloxone lasts 30 to 90 minutes. It would block it for that period of time.
So is it helpful in that way to try to wean yourself from, to keep yourself away from heroin?
No. So if you think about that, what we're trying to do is manage heroin addiction, also known as opioid use disorder. And we have much better medications for managing opioid use disorder. Medications are methadone, buprenorphine. Those both bind opioid receptors and turn them on, prevent a person from going into withdrawal. And a third newer medication, much less evidence-based, but looks like it works for some people, is called naltrexone. And that can be given as a one-month injection, and that also blocks opiates. That medication is emerging. The evidence is emerging. Some people like it. Most people are going to do best and be interested in buprenorphine or methadone.
I want to know how important naloxone could be to our heroin crisis, our opioid crisis. How many lives does it save in the Puget Sound area every, I don't know, month or year?
In the Puget Sound region, I would estimate we're probably saving it minimum dozens across Washington State. We're probably looking at, you know, certainly several hundred. What's important to understand about naloxone, it's an emergency rescue medicine. Only 1 in 20 people who have an overdose die. The person has to be there to give the naloxone. So what we know in a real world through research done at the University of Washington by Sean Sullivan and Dr. Philip Coffin is that there's about a 6% mortality reduction in the population of heroin users when naloxone is widely available. That's wonderful. It's necessary, but it's not sufficient. A 6% mortality reduction is great, but it's not enough. We have other tools, the medications I mentioned, buprenorphine and methadone, they have a 50% mortality reduction. So we have to have naloxone. It's very worthwhile, but it's clearly insufficient.
Of course, police tell us they use naloxone repeatedly on the same person, right? So someone can be saved and they may not be saved the next time.
Of course. So naloxone is an emergency rescue medication.
Yeah.
It's not managing a chronic condition.
Is naloxone a get-out-of-jail-free card that just enables a drug user to keep using?
It's a wonderful question. I'm just wrapping up research funded by the National Institutes on Health, where we distributed naloxone to half the people randomly and gave them education. There was no increased overdose risk in those folks. There's other research that shows the same thing. So if you think about it, for a person who's opiate dependent, naloxone puts them into immediate withdrawal. They feel terrible. That's the negative reinforcement of why they use opiates. So people are not going to use naloxone unless they absolutely have to because it makes them feel terrible.
Is the cost of naloxone breaking police budgets?
No.
Did you hear about the city council member in Ohio who said maybe there should be a limit on the number of times the police will revive you?
Well, so that's a really big thing to unpack. What I'll say really briefly is that the first priority for distributing naloxone, and I have several projects actually going on around the state, our first priority is to get it to active heroin users. They're at the highest risk for overdose. 20% have an overdose every year. 60% witness an overdose every year. They're going to respond to the most overdoses. So our first priority is, and we've distributed thousands of kits to heroin users around the state. Law enforcement is a great secondary or third step to take. There's additional benefit there, but the number of overdoses that they see and that they're going to reverse are much lower.
How do you want us, Caleb, to use naloxone differently from the way it's being used right now?
So naloxone is a gateway drug to a conversation about how do you treat the health condition that is driving opiate use. It's a gateway drug. I can start a conversation with you. I train you in overdose response. You become empowered. You learn more about this. You realize you have some power to actually save another person's life. And you also learn that the best overdose prevention is going to be actually getting on treatment medications. So I can start with saying, hey, here's this quick fix. Worthwhile. You should have it. Tell everybody in your life who knows that you use or who uses that you have it. But the real point is to say, and I care about you. I want you to be safe. I know that you want to be healthy. And the best tools we have for that right now are these two treatment medications, methadone and buprenorphine. If you've used them before and had bad experiences or good experiences, I encourage you to try them again. There are new, easier ways to access those medications, which I'm phenomenally excited about. And that's really what we want to do. And to get people engaged in that conversation and say, you know, let's get you off of the literal emotional and physical roller coaster of opioid addiction. You're going up and down nonstop. These treatment medications get you on level ground so you can deal with the rest of your life and stay alive.
Okay, then last question. You're talking about medications. You're a drug researcher. Mm-hmm. Is there a talk therapy that you are a fan of that gets at why our lives aren't good enough without drugs, to put that very simply? Is there, beyond medication, have you found something should know about?
So cognitive behavioral therapy works really well for addiction, but it is inadequate by itself. By far, the best evidence-based intervention are those treatment medications I mentioned. A huge study, United Kingdom, 150,000 people, found a double the overdose rate for people not in treatment or in counseling only compared to being on medications. The real upstream talk therapy I think we need as a society is just what we already know is the best prevention. The best prevention we have for alcohol and marijuana misuse, and which should totally apply to opiates, is teaching young people and adults how do you deal with physical and emotional distress. It happens to all of us. How do we build that resiliency so we're not reaching for a bottle of alcohol or pills or anything else, that we're really looking inward first to learn how to deal with stress? That is the magic talk therapy. It isn't magic, but it's having regular conversations about what do you do when a kid gets through the medication safety cap? What's the next conversation you're going to have? How do you make it normal to say stress is normal? It doesn't feel good, but there are positive ways to deal with it, whether it's getting social support or exercise or listening to music, whatever it is, that how to really reach out for that help and reach out for that support.
That's a conversation I want to have, resiliency in this crisis that we're dealing with around this region, this country. Caleb Banta-Green, Alcohol and Drug Abuse Institute, University of Washington, thank you so much.
You bet. Thank you.
You've helped put together a website with resources, right, to stop an opioid overdose, stopoverdose.org. Yeah, so we're going to tweet out a link to that right now, at KUOW. Today, by the way, is International Overdose Awareness Day. In Western Washington, we have plenty of spiders, butterflies, and those little bugs that walk on the surface of water. Those are cool. But there are two well-known insects who don't live here in big numbers, and a KUOW listener wants to know why.
Hi, my name is Tom Miller, and I have this question. I'm a transplant from Minnesota, and I'd like to know why there aren't more mosquitoes and fireflies out in Seattle and Washington.
Tom, we're going to get you an answer. Thanks to University of Washington entomology professor Patrick Tobin. Welcome.
Well, thank you for having me.
So there's Tom asking about fireflies and mosquitoes. Let's start with the bugs that bite us.
Mm-hmm.
Tom said he was really surprised we don't have more mosquitoes here.
I associate these things with standing water, right? They lay their eggs, or at least that was the story back in the Midwest. They lay their eggs and, you know, water comes up, they hatch. So I'm thinking, well, with all the rain we have out here and with the Puget Sound, I mean, there's certainly got to be more water here than anywhere in Minneapolis. And yet, you know, there's no mosquitoes.
Right. Professor, why aren't there more mosquitoes in moist Western Washington?
Yes, a very good question. And, you know, obviously we do have some mosquitoes here. Anybody who's been barbecuing at night knows that.
Mm-hmm.
But if you think about our rainy season, when do we get the rains? We get our rainy season primarily in the fall, late fall in the winter and early spring. And those are not good times for insects to be reproducing.
Too cool.
Most insects sort of pass the winter in kind of a hibernation type state, sort of like what we call a diapause. So it's the summer where insects are most, or all insects, including mosquitoes, are most prolific. And this summer has been a little bit unusual with the lack of rain.
Yeah.
But very little rain is common in most summers in Seattle. In addition to that, if you think about standing water, that's exactly where they like to breed. A lot of our water sources here in Western Washington are not exactly standing. We have some pretty fast-moving streams, or just streams that move in general.
What about Lake Union, Lake Washington? Would those be...
That's a good question. That is a nice freshwater lake. Those are good spots. It's too deep in most of the lake, but certainly on the shallow ends near the shoreline, they probably are reproducing populations of mosquitoes. Fortunately, the water is also kind of cool, which will slow down their development. So another reason why we may not have as many as other places, and Florida is a good example of mosquitoes. A mosquito in Florida, for example, can go from egg to adult in maybe 7 days. Whereas here, now, once again, this summer has been a little bit unusual in terms of the heat, but most of our temperatures in summer, it can take almost a full month for a mosquito to go through that same life cycle. So we just have fewer generations than they have in other places. We have fewer places where there is standing water because we typically have less precipitation during summer.
And when it does come down, it sometimes comes down lightly.
Not a big standing puddle left over. Absolutely. In fact, the primary source I always feel like for mosquito populations in urban environments are bird baths. Those are great places to.
Right.
I have yet to see a single bird bath anywhere in the summer, regardless of where I live, that didn't have mosquito larvae floating around in it.
How cruel to give the mosquitoes their best home right next to a bird that wants to eat them.
Well, I think in most cases, the birds are probably not eating them. Mosquito larvae are pretty tiny. I don't think they would make that much of a meal.
Okay.
And the bird probably just wants to do their thing and move on.
Okay.
They're looking for fat caterpillars.
True. I'm talking with University of Washington entomology professor Patrick Tobin, talking mosquitoes, but now let's move on to the other bug that our listener Tom wants to know about.
So I was just in Minnesota this past weekend, and there were fireflies outside in the backyard at this friend's house I was staying at, and we were talking about that. I said, I haven't seen one of those ever. In Washington, in Seattle. Not once.
Yeah, me neither. Haven't seen them since I was a kid. Why not?
Yeah, very good question. As someone who have spent most of my life living in the East, I can say the fireflies are quite spectacular. Now, turns out we actually do have fireflies in the Western United States, but the ones we have don't produce the light.
Wait a minute. A firefly that doesn't produce
light? I
know. Isn't that the one thing, the qualifying feature? To be a firefly.
You would think so, but they're also not flies. They're actually beetles.
Fair.
Maybe they're not well named. But there are several, there's over 2,000 species of fireflies or lightning beetles, lightning bugs, however you want to call them. A number of them do produce light. And the reason why they do it is to find a mate. In the species that we have here, we have a combination of daytime flyers that don't use light to find a mate. And we also have species that have used other type of cues to find a potential mate. They just have, for whatever reason, I don't know the answer to this question, but for whatever reason, the species that we have here have not evolved that strategy to find a mate, with the exception of a few species that have been recorded in Oregon.
Okay. So we have some. I'm not going to call them fireflies, though. I'm going to call them underperforming beetles who could be fireflies if they had just put out the effort.
So they're in the family called Lampyridae. So we could call them lampyrids don't light
with
up.
No lamp.
With no lamp. That's a good one.
Okay. I've heard that fireflies are declining even in the East.
Mm-hmm.
Why?
Very good question. A big part of it has to do with habitat loss. Another huge problem, particularly in the East for crepuscular, the dust flying and the nighttime flying, is light pollution.
Oh, it's too light for them?
It's particularly in dusk when it's already not exactly fully dark anyway.
Mm-hmm.
They're flashing to find a mate. And if light pollution is interfering with the ability for a male or a female to see that flash pattern, they don't find each other.
They're crying out for company and their mates can't see their light? That is the saddest thing I've ever heard.
It is. It is very sad. And to sort of follow up with that sadness, there's actually a particular species of fireflies where the females will mimic the flash of a mate for the sole purpose of luring that male in to eat him. So,
come on.
No, it's awful. We call them the femme fatale fireflies.
Yeah.
But yeah, light pollution is a major factor in their decline. So the fact that we don't have light-producing fireflies in a city like Seattle, which is, there's a fair bit of light pollution here in the city, that actually could be a benefit to the populations we have here. And we still got to deal with habitat loss, right? We deal with that anywhere, but at least we have one less concern.
Right. Are you sad that there aren't fireflies you can watch? I mean, you're a professional entomologist, and you can't see fireflies here.
Yeah, so my wife and I went to graduate school at Penn State, and instead of living close to campus, we found this wonderful farmhouse that was built in about 1805 in the middle of nowhere. It was almost as if we could have been in the witness protection program. Uh-huh. And the only neighbor we had a dairy farm, and that was basically it. Our neighbors were 160 cattle, or cows, I should say. But because it was so isolated in the middle of nowhere, there was absolutely no light pollution to speak of, other than maybe a porch lamp coming from our neighbor's house or our house. So that pitch darkness, particularly in summer, just facilitated seeing these fireflies that come out. And it was I remember when my wife's father, who was from grew up from Anchorage, Alaska, came out to visit us. He just had never seen such a sight. This constant flashing of fireflies that were just—it was just spectacular. But I do miss them. But you know, seeing Mount Rainier during the summer is pretty spectacular too.
Good trade-off.
Good trade-off.
All right. So a little sadness, and you feel sad about the lack of mosquitoes, I assume.
Oh, I feel awful about it. You know, I really wish there were more biting me.
If only. Patrick Tobin is a professor of entomology at University of Washington, and now listener Tom has his answers, why so few mosquitoes and fireflies. Thanks so much, Professor.
Great. Thank you for having me, Bill.
And you can submit your own local wonder question. We're tweeting out a link right now at KUOW. If you find a mosquito bite to be an unfortunate event, remember there's a place for those in life. The Lemony Snicket books, a series of unfortunate events, told the story of three siblings who become orphans and things get worse from there. The author, Daniel Handler, created the pseudonym Lemony Snicket. He's out with a book now called Goldfish Ghost, a child story about a dead fish. Daniel's wife, Lisa Brown, did the illustrations. Daniel and Lisa, hello.
It's a pleasure to be here.
And it is. Yes, it is.
Daniel, first, what do you have against happy endings?
I think it's more interesting when terrible things happen. I think that if you take a walk around your neighborhood and you are bitten by a dog, but also you see a ladybug, that when you get home and someone says, how was your walk? You're more likely to mention the fact that you were bitten by a dog.
Mm-hmm.
So
it makes a better story.
Yeah, and it's just more interesting. I think I find trouble and death and gloom to be just inherently entertaining. That's always been my way.
Lisa, do you think about happiness versus compelling misfortune in your illustration?
Yeah, I don't really think about happiness at all, I would have to say, in illustrations or in life.
Yeah?
Yeah, well, I'm Jewish. The expectation is that the worst will happen at any time.
It's a constant life of suffering.
Yeah. And I enjoy that.
You enjoy the expectation more than
of
the actual
suffering. Oh, no, I don't. Yeah. The suffering rarely happens.
Right. Suffering by definition, I don't think you can enjoy. I think you have to suffer through it. But other people's suffering or the anticipation of suffering can often be entertaining. I'm sure this is true for all of our Seattle listeners who live in a place that's almost always gray and threatening downpour. And I think there's a kind of citywide attitude that goes with that, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, we embrace the gloom.
There you go.
Yeah. Daniel, you've called childhood bewildering. What did you mean by that?
Gosh, did I only say that about childhood? I think that living life is bewildering. We're constantly told, particularly in childhood, that there's some kind of system in place that makes sense, a system of morality or expectation, and that, in fact, we are all of us lunatics wandering around with no idea what is going on or what's going to happen next, hoping that we can find perhaps people who will make us feel safe or a place where we can feel comforted. But for the most part, we are bewildered.
And you think kids don't buy the morality play or the pat ending?
Well, I don't think you have to be a child for very long or to travel very far to see that, for instance, behaving well does not necessarily mean you will be rewarded. You'll see kind of everyday injustice in the playground or around your dinner table, let alone out in the in the wider so-called adult world. So I think children are pretty wise to the false myths that are often thrust upon them.
Well, then why do so many of us want happy endings? Or don't we? I mean, I think of, for example, the Hollywood ending, right? That's the supposedly universally appealing way to tell a story.
Don't people like to cry at the end of a movie?
Well, they can cry from happiness.
Oh, yeah, that's true. I forgot about that.
I think everyone's different. What they like is different. When we're asked, well, will children enjoy reading about death and arson and destruction? We usually say, well, some of them will. I was a kid who was always obsessed with dark and gloom and sort of the eerie underbelly.
And it's funny how a kid might hate it and enjoy it, if those are the right words. But, you know, what a kid can suffer a story and still be thrilled or captivated, right?
Sure. A story or an incident.
Or an incident.
Not so long ago, I went into an elevator in a hotel, and there was a mother there and a child, and the elevator started to go down, and then it stopped between floors, and the lights went off. The mother was very frightened and was making noises. And I said to the child, well, if we die in this elevator, who do you think will have the more impressive funeral? Do you think people will really come out for you, or do you think people will come out for me? And we began to argue cheerfully about that and think about what kind of music we wanted played at our funerals. And I was insisting there would be far more people weeping and moaning. I mean, you know, this child didn't know me or anything. But we were having a grand old time, though also worried that it might happen, of course.
Sure. Your new book is Goldfish Ghost.
It is.
I understand your son was the inspiration behind it. True?
My son's dead goldfish.
Yeah.
More specifically.
And you're using goldfish there in the plural.
Yes. There were many of them. There are many dead goldfish in our own lives. But we were actually quite successful as young people with two goldfish that we had for years and years and years. We never cleaned their bowl.
No.
That was
probably
the
secret.
Yeah. Their names were Gene Hackman and Michael Caine.
Hmm.
And they lived till a ripe old age, as I hope Gene Hackman and Michael Caine.
Yeah, for a long time, the goldfish appeared to have the longevity of both those Hollywood stars, but they died. The goldfish, I mean.
The goldfish shared a bowl. I don't remember. Did Hackman and Caine share a film?
No, and that was the thing.
Oh.
Is that we couldn't think of a film that they were in together, so we put them together because we thought that would be the most brilliant film of all.
Yeah. This was before the days of the internet. I feel now there's someone in the audience saying, of course they were in a film together and can't wait to call in and correct us, but this is being taped, so we've already learned about our error and we're sorry for it.
But our son's favorite part of having goldfish were when they died and he was able to have a funeral.
That was the favorite part.
That was his favorite part.
What was so great about a fish funeral?
The coffins.
Yeah.
He loved the coffins.
Beautiful coffins.
Tell me about the coffins.
There were old jewelry boxes. You know, when you buy a necklace and you take it home in a little velvet lined thing.
Perfect. They snap shut.
Yeah. Mm. They snap shut. They're really tasteful.
Mm.
They're more tasteful than coffins for humans, I think.
Both felt lined in some cases.
Satisfying after an open coffin viewing, if just snap right shut. Oh, that would be great.
That's closure.
Yes. Look, excuse me, I have to make a change to my will.
What does your son and other children get out of a story about a goldfish ghost? Or do you care what they get out of it?
I think it's a story about feeling lonely and looking for companionship. It begins when the goldfish is dead, floating on the top of a bowl, and he's a ghost.
It doesn't begin with it dying. You're right. It begins with it already being dead.
Yes.
Right. Which is, he's born. He's not dead.
Right.
So he says he was born on the top of the
That's right.
water.
Yeah. So he wanders in ghost form all over a small seaside town looking for companionship. But it's difficult for him to find. We won't give away the ending, even though the book is a picture book and so can be read in 10 minutes. But he looks all over for companionship. And I think that there's not a child in the world who does not know the feeling of looking everywhere around one's surroundings and not seeing something that looks welcoming, whether you're trying to find where to sit at lunch or in the schoolyard, or if you go to a birthday party, if you're forced to go bowling.
Mm-hmm.
I was driven by a bowling alley recently, and I thought of all of the birthday parties I had to go to when I was a child that involved bowling, and how I hated bowling and how I was no good at it, and I would occasionally fake an injury or an allergy or something to stop myself from bowling badly. Bowling can be lonely. I wish you hadn't brought it up, frankly. Now I have a great sadness.
I still don't like bowling.
It's no fun.
It's not fun to do.
No.
You're rolling the same thing.
I think it's very brave of us to speak out on the radio like this, and I'm sure you're going to hear from bowling enthusiasts everywhere who I'm sure are charming people.
Yep.
But no bowling's doubt. No fun.
Am I giving too much away if I say you did get tempted by the happy ending with the goldfish ghost?
It's a satisfying ending. I mean, they're still dead when you come down to it.
Yeah. I don't know. Yeah, it depends what you mean by a happy ending.
Well, there's not a resurrection. That's true.
No. Yeah.
But
right. That's another book.
Yeah.
There's another book I'm thinking of. Oh, I can't think of what it is. Where there's a big resurrection.
Uh-huh.
Can't think of it. But
it did well.
It's a sequel.
It did
yeah.
Very, very well.
Yeah, but some people don't like it. So you never know with the book. No, but this is, I don't know if it's a happy ending. I like thinking a lot about what actually constitutes a happy ending as something that when I go to libraries or elementary schools to talk about a series of unfortunate events, I like to ask people what they think a happy ending would be. Because oftentimes someone will say, I wish, for instance, the bad beginning ended with Count Olaf being dragged off to jail. And I said, well, that's not really a very happy ending for Count Olaf. No one wants to be dragged off to jail. And they said, well, he's a villain. He shouldn't have a happy ending. And I thought, well, but you wanted a happy ending. Why doesn't he get a happy ending? It leads to a conversation of philosophical abstraction that is the delight of a certain number of children.
Finally, we're a news program.
Mm.
Do you reflect on current events in your work?
Sure. Well, I mean, this book is about wandering a new landscape, wondering if the landscape will take you in. So, for instance, I currently live in the United States, which is a country that is currently governed by an administration that's very much concerned with people coming into it and whether or not we should be welcoming to them. So, in a way, that's a conversation that happens. And I think that for me to make stories, it's important to be in a constant state of loneliness and bewilderment, which is certainly encouraged if you read the newspaper regularly, which I do. So I think being bewildered and making art go hand in hand. And so I'm grateful for news organizations for bringing me the bewildering state of the world, including KUOW. Won't you donate now? Every morning you listen and you can't believe the horrible things that are going on. Won't you give?
Give for loneliness and bewilderment.
That's right. Loneliness and bewilderment. Give now and we have a tote bag for you, I bet.
Do you recommend loneliness and bewilderment? Would you have us all be there with you?
Well, I mean, I think loneliness and bewilderment are melodramatic terms for, in fact, beautiful states of mind. So I like that they're melodramatic terms, but I think loneliness is a term for being alone, spending some time alone in the confines of your own head and feeling meditative about the world and feeling separate from it so that you may meditate on it as a separate entity rather than part of the swirl. And then bewilderment is in fact being part of the swirl, is understanding that you are surrounded by vastly different points of view and vastly different experiences and trying to find your way in that. So yes, I recommend loneliness and bewilderment, and I enjoy calling them by melodramatic terms for my own amusement.
That is Daniel Handler, who created Lemony Snicket. His newer kids' book is Goldfish Ghost. The illustrator is Handler's wife, Lisa Brown, who you also just met. And sure enough, Gene Hackman and Michael Caine were together in the 1977 film A Bridge Too Far. Why am I talking about that? You'd have to re-listen to the interview if you just tuned in. Talking about a pair of goldfish on the record. Thanks for listening. I hope you can listen tomorrow to the Week in Review. I'm Bill Radke. It's KUOW 94.9 Seattle.